Good evening. I had some things to sort out very quickly. It has been a beautiful afternoon. We had a great time at the gardens. If you were unable to make it, you missed out. We had, I want to say, 10 or 11 residents. They kept coming, so I kept losing track of how many there were, and I kept having to count again. And we were short a couple of people who were usually there, which was okay. We had plenty to carry the tune, and plenty of the residents assisted. It was a great time. And I want to encourage anyone who has opportunity to go out and to visit with them, not only in normal times, but specifically on our Sunday. It's the first Sunday of every month, outside of a few weird things. I've got to figure out if I guess next... The next first Sunday is Easter, and I had no idea. People would think that was very peculiar, I'm sure, in the world, but I don't know about those things. I don't keep track of Easter and such, but we're beginning a study in the book of Ecclesiastes. And if you wanted to go ahead and turn in your Bibles, Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Ecclesiastes is an interesting book in a large portion because so much of it is Solomon's attempt to find meaning in the world. Specifically, the phrase under the sun is going to play a big part in our understanding of the concepts in Ecclesiastes. And what he means is, as it pertains to the earth, as it is constrained to an understanding from this present existence. And a lot of the things that he's going to talk to have nothing to do with eternity, have nothing to do with moving beyond this. It only is constrained to the earth. And so that's a big, important part of the concept of the book of Ecclesiastes, and one of the reasons why it's a fairly difficult book to not just preach through, but ultimately to deal with, is because there's so much philosophy in it. And I don't personally like philosophy when we're talking about biblical concepts. I took a philosophy class in college when I was going to Ball State, and I loved philosophy until I took that class and actually understood what philosophy was. And philosophy effectively is the attempt to sound really smart while saying something really dumb. The smarter you can sound while saying something really dumb, the better philosopher you become. And I had an instructor who was adamant against Christianity, and of course I was convinced I was going to be the turning tide to his spiritual life. And I took a few weeks, in fact, trying to formulate an argument that would work for this instructor. And over the course of a few weeks, the more times we talked about creation, the more times we talked about the Bible, the more convinced I was that all of my work was vanity, as the writer of Ecclesiastes would say. And I tried to deal with him, but the problem ultimately with philosophy, in my experiences, some philosophers are interesting and they say interesting things or even useful things under the sun, but they're not concerned about the next life. They're not concerned about the future. They're not concerned about Christ because their focus is here. And there's not a lot you can do about that. So we deal with a world that's very much like that. In fact, in 2005, a long, long time ago, in 2005, Tom Brady was interviewed by 60 Minutes, the journalist Steve Croft. And despite the fame and the career accomplishments he had already achieved, 3 Super Bowl rings, in fact, Brady told Croft that it felt like something was still lacking in his life. Croft asked him, "What's your favorite Super Bowl ring?" And he answered, "The next one." "It's always the next one," he says, "that seems the sweetest," which implies that he is not necessarily able to appreciate the ones he's received so far. They ask him, "Why do you have 3 Super Bowl rings, or why do I have," he says, "3 Super Bowl rings and still think there's something greater out there for me? I mean, maybe a lot of people would say, hey man, this is what it's all about. I reached my goal, my dream, my life. Me, I think it's got to be more than this. I mean, this isn't all it's cracked up to be. This can't be everything." And when Croft pressed Brady as to what was right, or what the right answer was, he added, "What's the answer? I wish I knew." He says, "I love playing football and I love being quarterback of this team, but at the same time, I think there are a lot of other parts about me that I am trying to find." And the more people I talk to out in the world, the more people who are devoid of a relationship with God or don't really understand their relationship with God, the more I find this to be the case. Ecclesiastes is honest about the troubles of life. If you're in a bad mood, if you're feeling really down, Ecclesiastes is probably not the book you should read, because it'll make you feel worse. It'll make you feel like nothing really matters and like, well, this whole world is a big pile of flaming garbage. And sometimes, to be fair, it can be. More than any other book in the Bible, Ecclesiastes captures the futility and frustration of living in a fallen world. It is honest about the drudgery of work, the injustice of government, the dissatisfaction of foolish pleasure, and the mind-numbing tedium of everyday life. One thing I would encourage us all to do is think of the book of Ecclesiastes as the only book of the Bible written on a Monday morning. The book of Ecclesiastes, he says in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 1, he says, "The word of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem." And if we go over to 1 Kings chapter 2, we find out who that is. We already referenced him. And though there would be a couple of situations where there was some question as to who would be king, though David had already ascribed the kingship to Solomon, there were a couple of individuals who would attempt to usurp that throne, both during David's time, his own son, and even just shy of David's death. There would be some who would try to steal the throne. In 1 Kings chapter 2, notice in verse 12, if you go to verse 1, he says, "Now the days of David drew near that he should die, and he charged Solomon his son, saying, 'I go the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and prove yourself a man, and keep the charge of the Lord your God to walk in all his ways, to keep his statutes and his commandments, his judgments and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn.'" And then go to verse 12. "Then Solomon sat on the throne of his father David, and his kingdom was firmly established." And though there would be some usurpers, they would never make much end of it. If we turn over just a couple of chapters to 1 Kings chapter 3, why would Solomon write a book like this? Solomon was an individual who not only had a wisdom in the ability to choose things, and we'll see that here in 1 Kings chapter 3, but he had a curiosity. And that curiosity drove him, it seems. In 1 Kings chapter 3, notice in verse 5, "At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, 'Ask, what shall I give you?'" Now notice, that's an open-ended question. He could have asked for anything. He could have asked for anything that his heart desired. If asked that same question, what would you respond? Now, there's a big difference between what we'd like to say to that answer and or that question and the answer that we will likely give. But until we're really put in the situation, we may never know what we would truly decide. In verse 9, he says, "Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart." He talks about the greatness of the people of God and how important they are, not only to him, Solomon, but also to God, because they are his people. And they are an incredible people. And because you have chosen them, he says, "Give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours?" And if we were to remove wisdom from Solomon, the wisdom that was given by God to Solomon that we'll see in just a moment, I would say he was an incredibly wise individual to ask for such a thing. He has to be wise to ask for such an incredible thing that would help not only to sustain the people. He's also a selfless man. He's also an individual who is concerned, again, the idea of meekness that we talked about this morning. "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." As Jesus says there in Matthew chapter 5, as we're talking about the Beatitudes. This Solomon, he is a meek man of all the things he could have asked for. And he asks for wisdom so that he can judge and discern for the people of God. Notice verse 10, "The speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. Then God said to him, 'Because you have asked this thing and have not asked for long life for yourself, nor have you asked riches for yourself, nor have you asked the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall any like you arise after.' So much so that there would be kings and queens of different lands, of empires who would come to Solomon for wisdom, for understanding, in order to decide certain things. And they would come to find out if this man was really wise, and they would go away convinced that he was the real deal. And I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be anyone like you among the kings all your days, he says. The source of Solomon's great wisdom was originally Solomon, because he made the right choice. God gave him incredible wisdom, and you could argue that the wisdom that Solomon had even before God gave him this incredible wisdom was from the Lord. But Solomon demonstrated incredible wisdom, an incredible sympathy for his people, an incredible meekness in his willingness to decide what was best for the people rather than what was best for himself. And so he chose, and he chose rightly. He chose accurately that which was available to him. And so the message of Ecclesiastes is a very odd message in the end. It is not necessarily what I would expect from a Bible book. I think about all the books of the Bible, and I think about how many of them are devoted to encouragement, how many of them are involved in in confirming the people of sin and helping them make the transition into righteousness, of how many books were dealt to the people to help them through difficulties and struggle. And the book of Ecclesiastes, while it ends incredibly well, and we will talk about that pretty much every week, the journey is incredibly difficult through the book of Ecclesiastes. As we watch Solomon go through these things and try to find meaning in life, we notice there in verse 2, if you're back in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, the word of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem, verse 2, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. How many times can you say vanity in a verse? He's five right there. And he would attempt to break that record in the future, but for now the record is five. Five times he uses the word vanity, which means uselessness or pointlessness. And he looks around the world and the idea that he has come to, the conclusion he has come to about all things, and remember we have to restrict this to under the sun, all things are pointless, that there is no usefulness in this world. He goes to verse 3, what profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? If we go down to verse 12, notice in verse 12 he says, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. There it is. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. God gave us a curious mind, the desire to find out things, both to grope for him and to find answers to this life. And the culmination of all of those questions that we ask would lead us, hopefully, to an understanding of God and to a relationship with him. But as you have found in this life, that is not always the case. Both in our own lives, oftentimes, we find answers elsewhere, or at least attempt to. Find answers to the meaning of life and the purpose of our existence. And if you ask this world and the philosophers that exist, both small and great, both closeted philosophers and people who write incredible books about philosophies, they would come up with 1,000 different reasons and 1,000 different ways to find meaning in life. And the writer of Ecclesiastes, Solomon here, he would say, it's all pointless. It's all meaningless when it pertains to that which is under the sun. In verse 14, he says, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Tried to catch the fog once. Missed. You ever tried to catch air? You ever seen people selling bottles of air from various places? Try to catch the fog in your hands. It escapes just as easily. And he says that meaning is the same way, is that the things of this world are the same. They are all that is under the sun, indeed, is vanity and grasping for the wind. If we turn over to chapter 12, Chapter 12 and verse 8, he says, "Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity." See, that didn't even break our record. Our record is 5 times in a verse. He only used it 3 times there. But he concludes this section, that is pretty much the entirety of the book of Ecclesiastes, all the way through chapter 12 and verse 8, with this life under the sun, all that is in it, all the works that you could accomplish, all the things that you could have, and all the possessions you could receive, and all the pleasures that you could experience, are ultimately pointless. Now he's going to move on from there to talk about what gives life meaning, what makes this life worth living. But if you were to stop, and perhaps if Solomon were to end his lesson here in verse 8, this would be an incredibly depressing book. And in fact, it can be at times, talking about all the things and understanding the experiences that Solomon had and perhaps relating them to your own experiences in this world. And then he goes to verse 9. "And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs." And we have many of those unto today. "The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd." Now, if you stop there. So he took his wisdom and he applied it to the world, and he wrote many proverbs, many more than we have. But we have 30-some chapters of proverbs, of wise sayings, of not just philosophies, but useful things. And if that were the end of all that Solomon wrote, then it would have been pointless. It would have had no effect. But he keeps going. "And further, my son, be admonished by these, of making many books, there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh." Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter, verse 13. Here it comes. "Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all," or this is the whole duty of man. "For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil." Remember, the book of Ecclesiastes pertains to all things under the sun. And when he had come to the conclusion of all the attempts that he makes, and we'll go through some of them, all of the things that he tried to give his life meaning, and he came to the conclusion that nothing can give his life meaning under the sun. There is only one thing that gives your life meaning, that makes your life worth living, that gives you any kind of sense of accomplishment, of any kind of concept of purpose, and that is a relationship with God, the Father, the Creator of heaven and earth. There is a caution to be had here. Remember that this pertains to things under the sun. Of all the books of the Bible, Ecclesiastes is not one to be cherry-picked for proof texts of a point. You're trying to make a point. You're trying to find something that proves this concept that you have. Of all places in the Bible, do not cherry-pick the book of Ecclesiastes. Context is incredibly important because he speaks in a very poetic way, just like you wouldn't cherry-pick the Psalms, because the Psalms are poetry. They are written from a perspective of a human being talking about their experiences, of the things that are going on. And sometimes they are expressions of emotion, deep and seated emotion, just as sometimes we want to cherry pick pieces out of Ecclesiastes specifically. But remember, when he is talking from an idea, that he's talking about that which is under the sun. Unless you're talking about chapter 12, verses 9, 13 and 14, he's talking about things that are explicitly under the sun, relating to this world. And so we can't draw spiritual concepts from the earlier chapters in the way that we would normally. And so it is very dangerous for us to draw out of those places things that are talking about spirituality. But we like to, especially when something that he says happens to coincide with something that we would like to believe or something that we'd like to prove. So be cautious about that. And be cautious when others do it, just as you should be in anywhere in the Psalms, anywhere in Ecclesiastes, anywhere in Proverbs. But ultimately, be cautious when anyone tries to cherry-pick the Bible. That is to say, pull a verse out of context, pull a phrase out of the Scriptures, and trying to make it say something. always go back before you believe anything and check to see if what they are saying is accurate according to what is being talked about. This chapter, we're talking about chapter 1 in particular at this point. This chapter is, yes, pertaining to things that are under the sun, but ultimately earthly pursuits. The monotony of life under the sun. And that word doesn't even carry enough weight. I mean, the word monotony is an awful word, but it doesn't carry enough weight to talk about what he's getting at, and we'll get into it. In verse 3, he says, "What profit has a man from all his labors in which he toils under the sun?" And you would say, well, the profit he makes is his wage. That's not what he's talking about. One generation passes away and another generation comes in, but the earth abides forever. What happens to your stuff when you die? Goes somebody else. So all the work and the labor that you put into acquiring all of that becomes someone else's. And while you might like that next person in line that you are giving your stuff to, it's not going to be yours. The sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. Now remember, he's talking about all things under the sun. He's personifying the sun as an individual. The sun is a mass, right? A mass of gases that doesn't travel across our sky, technically. Actually, what's happening is the earth is rotating, it's turning. And as it does, the appearance of the sun comes up and goes down, but really we're the ones moving. And yet, he personifies the sun as one who is active, as someone who moves across the sky. But what happens at the end of the sun's day? At the end of the day, he goes down, and what happens the very next day, about 8 to 12 hours later? Comes right back up the other side and goes right back across the sky. Talk about pointlessness. Talk about futility. Monotony. Does anything change? Not really. Nothing under the sun, he says, is different. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind swirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. The wind just keeps moving. Does it ever really accomplish anything? Is there a mind to the wind that gets something done? Does it accomplish anything in truth? All it does is move from one place to another and then back again. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full to the place from which the rivers come. There they return again. Now, they were smart enough to understand the water cycle. God is providing a concept here that they basically understood. I mean, if it kept raining continually like it did in Noah's day, they would have been overwhelmed by water, and yet this flood wasn't a regular occurrence. So where did the water go? And elsewhere, the Bible would talk about that, that it goes back up into the sky and describes the water cycle in a more particular way. Here, he's talking about the water that rains down, it feeds the earth, it takes care of things. But then all it does is turn around, go back up, and come back down again. Talk about monotony. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. I don't even have to listen to the radio that long to know that. There's nothing new under the sun. The movies they come out with, remakes, they're constantly reusing everything they've ever used before because there are no real new ideas. Not in truth. Everything is a subsidiary of something else. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? You remember the people in Athens and what they were trying to find. They were constantly on Mars Hill. They were constantly on this location talking about things, hoping to find some new thing. But when it was offered to them, they didn't want it in the same sense as they wanted other things. It has already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of the things that are to come by those who will come after. There will come a time where history will be forgotten. As important as 9/11 has been in the past, and the United States has attempted to remind us regularly of the events of 9/11, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but there will come a day where no one will remember what that means. it will be September 11th of whatever year that is, and no one will think twice about it. Just as the events, even in World War II, of the Holocaust and the things that have gone on are passing from people's minds. Just as the events of previous historical events and things that were really important to the people of their day. How far back can you go historically thinking about and remembering events that took place? Unless you spend lots of time remembering and studying. And yet to the people of their day, these were events that were incredibly important. Of the utmost importance. And yet they have passed from memory and they've become nothing in the history of the world. This chapter is about earthly pursuits, the monotony of life under the sun. There is no end to the laundry, the dishes, the sweeping. You'll do it, and you will do it again and again until your time on earth is done. Because you will keep using dishes, and you'll keep wearing your clothes, and you'll keep, really most of the time when you're cleaning, you're picking up dead skin cells, and you'll keep shedding them, and you'll keep dragging in dirt from the outside. Sometimes all it feels like you're doing is pushing dirt from one place to another. And I remember a congregation who, in an attempt to facilitate or separate people from people who wanted to work and people who didn't, people who were willing to do something for that which they received and those who just wanted a free handout, there was a congregation who bought a big pile of gravel and they put it out behind the congregation. And when someone would come from the world for help, with whatever it was, for money specifically, they would hand them a shovel. And they would tell them that they would pay them by the hour, right, to move this stone. We need it from this place to the other place. And if the person was working 15 minutes after they had asked them to work, they'd go out and they would give them help, assistance. They wouldn't make them work the whole hour or work up and all the time that they had to in order to earn what they needed. They were just checking whether they would work at all. Or attempt at all. And you know what happened when that big pile was empty? They moved it back. That's the way the world works. All we do is shuffle things from place to place, move things back and forth. Probably we feel quite like Sisyphus. For his great arrogance, he was punished by the Greek gods. Not in reality, this is a story. But this man supposedly was punished by the Greek gods to roll a boulder up a hill every day until he reached the top. Unfortunately, the stone was enchanted to roll back down the hill just before it reached the pinnacle. And so for eternity, Sisyphus, according to this Greek mythology, pushes that stone up the hill. Sometimes I feel like Sisyphus. What point has my life had? What accomplishment have I made? What difference have I wrought? If God is not real, life is entirely pointless and ultimately vain. And that is Solomon's point. Some people in this world understand that. If I were not a Christian, and I'm speaking this from a personal perspective, if I were not a Christian, what would you do? And so some people, when they come to this conclusion that God does not exist, it's a wrong conclusion, but they come to it, they strive to be remembered in history books. They strive to find statues of themselves erected from the great things that they've done. And they do such things hoping to give meaning to their lives. They're hoping to matter. They're hoping to make a difference. Some become monsters in order to be remembered. Some people will do awful things simply to be known because they know that nothing else will change. Nothing else will keep them remembered. There are many individuals, many of the school shootings where the people involved, that's how they felt. They felt invisible. They felt like they didn't matter, like they had no effect on the world. And because of it, they found a way to matter in the most horrible way possible. But they would be remembered, and so they would become slightly immortal in their minds. They would become slightly more important into the world, even if for an awful reason. Or they entirely give up on meaning and chase pleasure to the end. You probably know people like that too. Who don't care about meaning, who don't care any longer about morality, or even the concepts of morality in the culture. They give themselves fully to pleasure, and they don't care at all about the consequences. In Philippians chapter 3, we find the struggle. Here, he's describing this struggle, the struggle between what seems to matter and what really matters. And the world cannot grasp this. The world not only struggles with this, but they fail miserably. Notice in Philippians chapter 3, Paul very accurately represents the feeling of the world. He says, "For many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you even weeping, that they are enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly, and whose glory is in their shame, who set their mind on earthly things." I had friends in school who kept a tally of their purveyance sexually, of the individuals they were involved in. And to them, it was a sign of respect or a sign of accomplishment, which is nonsense, which is ridiculous. All to be remembered, all to fulfill some base and disgusting, deteriorated sense of self-worth. But what really matters is the very thing that the writer of Ecclesiastes commented there in verse 13 and 14 of chapter 12. The whole of man is to serve God and keep His commandments. The whole of man, all the duty that is prescribed to man, all the things that he can accomplish, and all the great things that he can do. Matthew chapter 6, Jesus talks about this core, essential, fundamental nature of humanity. He says in there in verse 19, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." If you go to verse 33, "But seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. Therefore do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble." Now Jesus wasn't an optimist in the sense. He was a realist. He understood how this world worked. He understood how life was for the people of His day. And He wasn't telling them to be happy because they were going to be persecuted, but because of what that persecution or what those troubles and what those difficulties would accomplish in them. It's the very thing that Paul argues. Numerous places, Peter and James all argue the same point. In James chapter 1, verses 2 and 3. Excuse me. "That you shouldn't be concerned when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience." It's an opportunity for you to grow. And no, it's not pleasurable in the moment, but distressing. But it can be so much more if we allow it to be, because there is a hope of something more. Now, Christ, if God were not real, this world would be the same. This world would be awful. Technically, if God wasn't real, this world wouldn't exist. But let's pretend for just a moment that God doesn't exist, that He's not real, and this world somehow came about into its existence out of nothing. Let's not get started on that. Let's just assume that they're right, for argument's sake. Then what does this world matter? What does this life offer? What is the point of any of these things? And the writer of Ecclesiastes, for 12 and a half chapters, argues there isn't a point. There is nothing to be accomplished. There is nothing that matters. Now, when we finish the very end of the book of Ecclesiastes, we come to the point. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. The very thing that his father tried to encourage him to do from the very get-go. You remember there in 1 Kings chapter 3? David goes to his son and he says, "You need to follow God's commands. You need to fulfill them as they are written out for you, for your instruction and for your wisdom." And it was an opportunity for him to do what really mattered rather than simply what seemed to matter. And this world is good at making things seem to matter. This world is good. The devil is good at confusing us and confounding the issue of making us feel like things matter that don't really, and making things that really do matter, not only to God, but need to matter to us, as if they don't really matter, as if they're not terribly important. But our relationship with God must be foremost in our minds. And if you are not in a right relationship with God, if you have not committed to His will, being saved according to the covenant of righteousness in Christ, you can do so tonight. You can fear God and keep His commandments. You can fulfill the whole duty of man in obedience to His will and a continued work in His kingdom. If you tonight have walked away because of the futility of this world and its confusing nature, then you can change tonight. You can put on Christ and you can take back that mantle. You can take back that life in Him, and you can pursue what really matters once again, a relationship with Him and a place beyond this life, beyond the things and the difficulties of this life and the pain and the suffering and the struggle. And you can receive the reward that is waiting for each and every one of us who are His. If we can help you, I pray that you would let it be known as together we stand and sing.